Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review, as today we talk about the management of gastroesophageal cancers with Dr. Yelena Janjigian from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and Dr. Zev Wainberg from the UCLA School of Medicine in Los Angeles. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. In all of our webinars, we have a one-minute survey for you to take at the beginning and end of the program. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of what we're doing here today. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Klempner on gastrointestinal cancers. We're doing webinars all the time, particularly our Year in Review series. We'll continue with that next Tuesday, looking at Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And then on Thursday, we'll pick back up with hepatobiliary cancers after the GI Cancer Symposium and a really ground-shaking trial, the Emerald-1 trial, looking at IO with a taste or aftertaste. Year in Review bladder cancer on the 22nd of February, prostate cancer the 28th. And then for March, where we bring it back, our general medical oncology weekend. We're bringing 35 investigators to our hometown here in Miami, and we're going to spend the whole weekend. It's all online if you want to check it out that way or join us here in Miami. We have a special session on Friday night. We'll talk about metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, but we want to talk to clinicians with breast cancer. If you know of any oncologists or oncology nurses who have breast cancer who might want to share their story with us, let them contact us, or maybe you can contact us. Here's the program for the rest of the weekend. But here we're talking about gastrointestinal cancers. I was telling our faculty, I find things are getting a little more complicated here than they were a few years ago. So we'll see if we can untangle a few of these things over the next hour. As we do in all of our Year in Review programs, I met with each one of our faculty in the last week to record their presentation. So the link to that is in the chat room, and we'll send you an email with the link to this webinar as well as these two presentations. The best way to digest this is to watch the two presentations and then listen to the webinar. There are a lot of papers covered in these two talks, and I encourage you to really sit down with it and go through it. The faculty did a fantastic job going through all of these studies, and today we're going to just kind of try to take it to the next level and pick out a number of issues to talk about. And Zev, I kind of layered in the idea of common questions from oncologists about gastrointestinal cancers, and I can tell you there are a lot of them. I infiltrated, I think, about 30 of them into the slide set. We'll see how many we can get through, but there's so much happening. Before we get started, any perspective you can put on what's been going on in this disease? To me, it's really been incredible what's happened the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, amongst the GI cancers, certainly maybe HCC a little, obviously HCC as well, but certainly we've seen an explosion of drug development in gastroesophageal cancer. I think it stems from both recognition that immunotherapy has a important role to play in the majority of patients with gastroesophageal cancers, and also the way in which we're able to globally do studies. So the big change we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years is that we're able to bring a lot more drugs to patients if we do a lot of these global studies, because we recognize that Southeast Asia really has the majority of these patients. We have a lot too, of course, but you know, when we were able to do all these studies together, which was prior to the last 4 or 5 years, not a lot of them were, fewer, let's put it that way, were done globally. We're able to get these data out into patients.
So here's sort of a preview of what we're going to go through here today. We're going to start out trying to untangle a little bit more first-line therapy and metastatic disease. Then we'll go through a bunch of other papers that Yelena reviewed in her talk on immunotherapy. Then we're going to talk about targeting HER2 in the first line and second line setting with newer agents, obviously TDXDs, zanidatamab, the bispecific. We're going to then talk about Claudin 18.2 and zolbetuximab. And finally, if we have time, I pulled a bunch of papers from this past year from the two of you, which are fascinating. We have time, we'll kind of get into. Again, just to get back to Yelena before we get started, When you think, any questions or misperceptions that you see in the community about, I know it's sort of a broad question, about the management of gastroesophageal cancers, any areas of confusion or things that you see as people try to go through all these data and apply it to their patients, Yelena?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I guess less so the a confusion rather than maybe area that can still be improved on is, from what I understand in reviewing real-world data from Merck and BMS and other companies, is that in first-line setting, only about half of our patients get routine biomarker testing still, which is very disappointing to me personally. We spend so much time talking about nuances of this study and that study and try to get as many options to patients as possible. But I just saw a patient who flew in from Ohio, actually, for an opinion, and the gastric cancer metastatic, there were no biomarker testing, and the patient was offered standard, for some reason, capecitabine and oxaliplatin therapy. She, at least, it could have been that she forgot that they talked to her about it, but I mean, she had a lot of family members with her who were taking copious notes, with me at least, and biomarker testing was not mentioned to the patient. So I think for, you know, our colleagues, it's important to realize that only routine testing reflexively on all patients for PD-L1, HER2, MSI, and now Claudin is important. I think perhaps what I see people get sort of tangled up with is the distinction between esophageal G-junction and gastric cancer, because some of these historic studies artificially separated those anatomic locations. I can tell you in the United States, there's very few true only esophageal adenocarcinomas. Most of these are G-junction tumors, or they at least abutting or crossing the G-junction, and some of them are gastric. So simplify your life. If it's adenocarcinoma in metastatic setting, we approach it exactly the same. All of the patients need to get biomarker tested, and then we can decide risk-benefit ratio of whether or not to give them first-line anti-PD-1 therapy, combination of HER2 anti-PD-1, or anti-PD-1 therapy, or, you know, nowadays, Claudin inhibitors with chemo.
Well, that's exactly where we're about to head, and I was just flashing when you started talking about biomarkers. When we just did three CME programs at the recent GI Cancer Symposium, and we said the theme was three words: biomarkers, biomarkers, biomarkers.
Yep.
And all throughout oncology in general, GI in general, and actually relevant to that, I'm going to make another attempt to try to kind of get into some of the things that I think people are having challenges with, because I personally have challenges with. Zev, this is one of your papers that we listed here. I think we have it here. It's 11 pages of dense text on just PD-1 inhibitors and the treatment of esophageal adenocarcinoma. So I'm going to try to get more to the bottom line about this. And we've tried a lot of different ways over the last couple years to do this. But here's the way we thought. Here's the paper that Zev wrote as a fantastic paper. If you're an oncology fellow, I want to learn the whole approach. And there are many others. Yelena has, et cetera. But let's see if we can try to make it a little bit more straightforward. And also, I'd like maybe to elaborate a little bit more about the histology thing that you just mentioned, Yelena, because I think that, to me, I find confusing. So here's a ASCO guideline, immunotherapy and targeted therapy. We're going to show some of the other things later. All we did was take the abstract, not all the stuff in the, you know, in the paper. The paper's also, you know, huge. There's like a ton of stuff in it. All we did was take the abstract and break it down by each sentence in the abstract. Okay? So this is the this is the first sentence of the abstract. The first three sentences of the, because you have to actually read this whole thing together, but we broke it out. So let's talk about biomarkers and the use of IOs, first-line therapy in metastatic disease. So, Zev, you're part of the panel that says with gastric adenocarcinoma, CPS greater than 5, first-line therapy, Nivo and chemo. Then the thing says esophageal, gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma, CPS greater than 5, Nivo and chemotherapy. first-line therapy with pembro and chemotherapy recommended for HER2-negative patients, esophageal or GE junction AC, PD-L1 greater than 10. So, Zev, can you, and then this last one, esophageal squamous, much as we were saying, much more immune-sensitive, PD-L1 greater than 1, Nevo plus chemo, or Nevo plus Ipi for these patients with esophageal squamous, PD-L1 greater than 10, pembro plus chemo. And I don't know if they specified cis versus gem with the pembro. But Zev, can you kind of take this and, you know, kind of give your take on how a doc should look at first-line therapy of metastatic disease,
looking
at histology, you know, and this is the second-line paclitaxel RAM. But here's the question that I think this generates. So how do you sort through primary tumor location, histology, and PD-1, decide what to do? How do you decide which IO and which chemo, Zev?
Right. So good question. And I think, you know, guideline papers are designed ideally to try to make things less confusing for clinicians. But sometimes, obviously, the opposite happens, because what guidelines do, in essence, and this was the ASCO guidelines, but the same thing to some extent could be said for NCCN or other guideline papers. They follow the circumstances by which the study was done. So, for example, the reason why they're recommending chemotherapy in plus pembrolizumab in esophageal squamous with PD-L1 greater than 10, CBS 10, is that's where the study showed its greatest benefit. So you have to keep that in mind, that it's a recommendation that is trying to adhere as best as possible to the context and the patient population that was studied in that trial. Now, if we put all that aside and sort of look globally at the situation and sort of collectively look at the body of evidence that exists, both with pembro and nevo, we'll begin with squamous cell, where I think squamous cell is a little simpler in some respects. You have support for chemotherapy plus nevo, chemotherapy plus pembro, or ipi plus nevo in metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, with a clear suggestion that the best bang for your buck here is with CPS high patients. So, you know, and then it becomes a clinical decision. You know, it becomes a, hey, what does the patient feel right? Do they need the chemo? Well, then, okay, we'll give chemo plus nevo or chemo plus pembro. A little bit of this is trying to, you know, clearly following the suggestion that the PD-L1 high patients, at least 5, and in my opinion, in squamous cell, even 1 or more, should get a checkpoint inhibitor with chemotherapy. Now, in adenocarcinomas, particularly of the stomach or GE junction, I think now we have the CheckMate 649 and the Keynote 859, which at the time that guideline was written didn't exist or wasn't public. And we know that the patients with CPS greater than 5, and in pembro's cases greater than 1 or 10, should get a checkpoint inhibitor in HER2-negative disease. Where it gets, I think, confusing for people in the community is what to do with the CPS less than 5 or in some cases 0, and what to do with those patients. Should we or should we not add a checkpoint inhibitor? And there you see sometimes discrepancies between what the guidelines have written and what the FDA has approved. So, and for that, we've been apologizing for that a few years, that there's confusion for the community. It is a bit confusing, particularly because the FDA differs in its guide, in its approvals from what most guidelines say.
But then the other issue is actually managing the patient in front of you, particularly a patient who wants to be involved in treatment decisions. You know, I mentioned we're doing a series on, you know, medical oncologists with cancer. You may get very informed patients. Yelena, can you kind of put your mark on this whole question, and particularly the issue that Zev just brought up, the CPS 0 to 5?
Yeah, so I think historically there haven't been much in terms of targeted therapy for those patients. And so, you know, then the question came in, how sure are you it's clearly CPS negative sample, quality of the sample, tumor content, and so forth. And I think most oncologists, realistically, if it was indeterminate or there was at least some weak staining, would lean on the side of giving immunotherapy in combination with chemo, because in the United States, it's the only opportunity to give someone immune checkpoint blockade. We don't have approval in second or third line, unlike Asia where they do. Increasingly, the biomarker field has evolved, and so now we have claudin inhibitors. Although claudin, inhibitors, zolbetuximab, is not yet available in the clinic, we're starting to test for claudin IHC in our institution. We do it now routinely. So now we would agree that if a tumor is claudin positive and CPS less than 5, we would, in the very near future, recommend combination of zolbetuximab plus chemotherapy. So that's kind of where the, things changed. I think we know that for patients with less than 5, they typically, the benefit is not as durable and their survival benefit is not as robust. So I think in 2024, it would be reasonable to restrict by PD-L1 using the CPS-5 cutoff.
And again, there's always involving the patient in some of these controversial decisions. I'm just kind of curious, Yelena, in terms of quality control of PD-1, particularly in the community. I mean, how often do you think a CPS of 2 really could be 5 or more?
Yeah. Well, you ask me the question because you know how I feel about this probably. But the truth is it's very unreliable, especially in these intermediate categories. I think CPS 3 to become CPS 5 often is just, pathologist re-examining and counting some more cells. CPS 0, completely negative, is a bit more definitive if there's good quality of a sample. What we find is these clinical samples. And, if you travel or give talks in other hospitals, I often like to break the ice by asking, clinicians, in your institution, what's the rate of CPS 5 or greater? And most folks say that it's less than 50%, where phase 3 data, it's 50 to 60% of tumors. And the change there is not patient enrichment. It's just quality of the sample and quality of the testing. In phase 3 settings, we often have, tumor blocks. To get on the study and to be randomized, you have to have a lot of tissue. It's not the case in clinical practice. You usually get, just scant sample, just enough to diagnose the cancer. Often there's no, not a repeat endoscopy or biopsy done, especially for signet ring histology where the tumor is submucosal and you may not get a good enough sample. So you're absolutely right. You have to discuss the pros and cons of PD-1 therapy with your patients. Claudin inhibitors have their own, class effect, which is nausea, and they don't improve response rate in first line settings. So there's going to be a balance. And the truth is, most real world oncologists have a lot of PD-1 inhibitors on their standard sort of formulary. Zolbetuximab will only be approved so far for gastric cancer. So it will just be a matter of also how do they have routine claudin testing available and do they even have zolbetuximab in their on their formulary.
So, yeah, a lot to be said about zolbetuximab and prevention and management of a GI issue. So let's try to get down into the nitty-gritty, particularly in terms of clinical application. Here are some of the papers that Yelena reviewed looking at adjuvant neoadjuvant therapy. You can see the first one there, more follow-up from the CheckMate 577, some more biomarker studies, and then two big studies that came out in gastroesophageal cancer looking at adenocarcinoma using checkpoint inhibitors, a Pembro study that was negative, but a Durva study that's at this point showing increased path CR, and then this last paper, some interesting things related to this study looking at camrelizumab that interestingly was looked at with nab-paclitaxel. So here are some of my questions that come out of that. I'll start with you, Zev. We'll start with the most common adjuvant situation post-chemoradiation therapy. Can you talk about how you think through neoadjuvant treatment in general in gastroesophageal cancer? Again, how you use histology, location, PD-1 level to decide whether to use adjuvant IO, which IO, and for how long?
Right. So for neoadjuvant, let's start esophageal cancer. If it's esophageal cancer, I think we all, whether it's squamous or adeno, give carboplatin and radiation, the cross regimen. I mean, that's been the standard, and there's no IO during that regimen. That regimen is chemotherapy and radiation, and if patient's a candidate for surgery, surgery. After surgery, there is the Checkmate 577 study that shows you should give Nevo as long as there was a small amount of residual disease or any residual disease. And I think that study really was clear and convincing that the group of patients with either squamous or adeno should be offered Nevo. And in my opinion, that should be regardless of CPS score at this point. In terms of choosing adjuvant, neoadjuvant for gastric cancer, if it's gastric cancer and even GE junction cancer, some oncologists prefer FLOT as opposed to carboplatin radiation. If there's no esophageal involvement, people feel like FLOT is just as good, and certainly in some respects there's no need to radiate tumors that are at the GE junction. I would say that's tumor board dependent and oncology group dependent, and I've seen it both ways for a number of years now. And if they can handle FLOT, they get FLOT followed by surgery followed by more FLOT. There is not yet evidence that we should be adding checkpoint inhibitors to that mix yet. The studies that have been presented publicly, you just alluded to, KEYNOTE 585, did not meet its primary endpoint, even though it had a PATH CR improvement. And the Matterhorn study, while larger and a little simpler in design because it was just FLOT, exclusively FLOT, also has a PATH CR endpoint, but we just don't have the data yet on event-free survival, let alone overall survival. So we just need to wait a little bit longer, in my opinion, before we incorporate neoadjuvant immunotherapy in these diseases.
So, Yelena, just to follow up on that, we'll show the Matterhorn data with durvalumab in a second. But the question that we hear is, what's it going to take to bring this strategy to the clinic? At this point, it looks like we have some PATH CR. Is progression-free survival or event-free survival, is that going to be enough to do treatment? And another very common situation oncologists have, they see people who, you know, don't do well that well on FLOT. Any situations where you'd use post-op IO in a patient, say, who got pre-op FLOT, Yelena?
Yeah, so it's interesting. After I presented the data, I've been chatting with some of my colleagues, and they were actually saying that exactly what you said, that some patients have a hard time with FLOT. And then if the event-free survival reads out positive in the end for Matterhorn, they may actually use it as an opportunity just to give doublet chemotherapy even in perioperative settings. So try with FLOT, and if there's an issue, just drop the docetaxel and do 5-FU oxaliplatin with immunotherapy. The Matterhorn data suggests that FLOT is feasible globally. The treatment delivery was very good. 90% of patients or more got a pre-op all cycles, and 64% got adjuvant all cycles. But I agree with you. It's not for everyone. I think the biggest hurdle, if the data is positive, will be to help people understand that FLOT is doable in regular practice, especially in non-specialized practice, where the oncologists find that the cross regimen is very easy to give, with even for adenos, even though we know it doesn't do well for adenos. But, you know, it's one step at a time. We have to demonstrate event-free survival benefit first.
Yeah, Neil, I completely agree with Yelena's point there that, you know, if that event-free survival is positive, which we probably won't find out for at least another year or so, then you could see a lot of extrapolation certainly into doublet chemotherapies like FOLFOX in the neoadjuvant space, which a lot of people find simpler and more tolerable than FLOT. There's big questions in the field certainly about can you get away with FOLFOX instead of FLOT for a lot of people in the neoadjuvant space who just aren't FLOT candidates. And some of those studies are ongoing now as well.
So I thought this was really fascinating, this study looking at another IO camrelizumab, because what was interesting about it was that they randomized between the chemo. So one group didn't get one group got chemo alone, one group got paclitaxel, cisplatin, and the IO camrelizumab, but the other group got cisplatin, paclitaxel, and nab-paclitaxel. And amazingly, they actually saw greater benefit. That's in the lower right there, correct, Yelena? That on the left is with the nab.
The blue. Yeah.
You know, we've heard a lot about corticosteroids being used in management of autoimmune toxicity, but this is corticosteroids in, you know, being given for emetic issues, you know, early up front. So any thoughts about this? I was shocked. I don't know. I was just shocked. It's very interesting. Any thoughts, Yelena?
You know, I think this is an important study that was able to demonstrate that the backbone of chemotherapy matters. We've also looked at difference of what 5-FU platinum does versus taxanes, and those appear like paclitaxel appears to be the same as 5-FU platinum, but nab-paclitaxel in breast and in lung cancer, there's data to suggest actually it performs better as a backbone for combination. It's a wake-up call for us, especially in the United States, where we don't have access for gastric cancer to nab-paclitaxel. While in Asia, in Japan, it's actually part of their guidelines, so in second line. So makes me want to rethink second line strategies, especially for adenocarcinoma. And certainly for squamous cell cancer, perhaps we could consider that as well. In the United States, though, for squamous cell first line, we still use 5-FU platinum as the backbone.
So I want to talk about the use of novel immunotherapy. This seems to come up more and more as we move into the immunotherapy era. Yelena, you presented in your talk the RATIONALE 305 and 306 trial using tislelizumab. But the question I was just kind of curious about, and I'm curious how the audience would think this through. I'm going to start with you, Zev. So this is sort of an agree-disagree. I want to know whether you agree or disagree with this statement. In choosing between IOs for GE cancers, in general, the results from trials evaluating the more recently developed agents, tislelizumab, sintilimab, for example, are indirectly so similar to those of the commonly used agents that if there's a difference in cost or ability to access specific IOs, I have no problem substituting the other agent if I can. Agree or disagree?
Agree, with the caveat that first of all, I don't know if I would consider these novel agents. They're basically Chinese developed PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. So they've just been developed. These studies are done exclusively in China, and so the variables here are less sometimes what the IO is and what the patient population is. Just one variable and point to make. But in principle, most of these studies, and that includes tislelizumab, sintilimab, and all of the others that were done almost exclusively in China, do show very similar results to Pembro and Nivo studies that were done in a more global manner. So generally speaking, I would agree with this statement.
So, Yelena, any thoughts on this? You know, we used to ask this question by saying if one of them was 50% less, but it's not just about that. A lot of times in practice, you know, it's hard to access specific agents. Maybe insurance, we were talking about CLL Tuesday night, and the faculty was like, you know, use the one you can get because it's hard to sell, indirectly separate them. But, and then, you know, all you have to do is, I use the durvalumab example in non-small cell lung cancer. Pembro is the only IO used, and then all of a sudden there was a positive durvalumab study after chemo radiation. And the Pembro study didn't look as good. Now everybody uses Durva. Is that the way you see, you know, kind of the overall situation here? And what about this issue of Asian patients? I think we skipped through some data you showed in your presentation. I forgot which trial it was, which showed it wasn't a difference in the Asian and non-Asian. Any thoughts, Yelena?
Yeah, that was the Matterhorn study where the right. odds ratio for Asian patients in Asia was the same as the U.S., even though they had more advanced stage disease. I think all PD-1 therapies are similar. Anti-PD-L1, though, there may be some concern of the difference. But let's say exactly similar to the Pacifico study in lung, if Matterhorn is positive and we don't, you know, the payers won't reimburse for nivolumab or pembrolizumab in perioperative setting, durvalumab will be what the institutions will have to have on their formulary to use for early stage gastric. With Tisley and Sintilimab, it's slightly different story. You know, they just started the studies later, and a lot of their studies were primarily in Asia. So, you know, I think it wouldn't necessarily prevent from FDA from approving these agents in the United States. But unless there's a specific angle, I don't see why the clinicians would all of a sudden start using them, because it's just there's too many options. And if you have Nivo and Pembro on the formulary, I just practically don't see people getting these drugs unless there's some novel combination with a other, let's say, immune targeting or tumor targeting antibody or TKI.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get with the Pacific study. These are the data from the ESMO meeting of these two studies, Rationale 305 and 306, that Yelena goes through in detail in her talk. But again, very hard indirectly to separate out from the data we already have with other IOs. And, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe what's going to happen in the future, you know, to me, it might be trials like this that distinguish trial. I don't know, Zev, if you want to comment on that. This is using Tisley with chemotherapy with this DKN-01. If a trial like that were positive, then I guess you would stick with the IO that was used there. Any thoughts about this and other combination strategies coming down the lines, Zev?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we know is that there's a good segment of patients who are, you know, certainly sensitive to these checkpoint inhibitors. And the idea is now, okay, when we move beyond a checkpoint inhibitor to some either novel targeted therapy or novel immunotherapy drug, what's the best way to combine this? And can we confirm that there's a contribution of components, which is a critical element, obviously, before getting FDA approval? So a lot of the backbone studies we're going to see now moving forward are not going to probably be compared to chemotherapy alone, but are going to be compared to chemotherapy with either Nivo or maybe Pembro. That's going to be up to each individual company to decide. But obviously, we're going to expect to see that kind of trial moving forward. In terms of what will, you know, that's something certainly the future will determine, whether we can swap one or the other. And quite frankly, like Yelena said, some of these drugs might be biosimilars in the next few years. So time is moving pretty fast here. So these are going to be real world things that we'll encounter not too far from now.
So we're going to move on now and talk about HER2-positive disease, but maybe as a little bit of a palate cleanser. I mentioned we have the best chat room in the business here. So, Yelena, tell me what you think about Neela's patient. So here it is. I saw a patient today who's on the pre-op Pembro trial where he got two doses of Pembro and went to surgery. Was found to have no response, has now completed chemo radiation, and his tumor is HER2-3+. I'm afraid not to add on any anti-HER therapy. Thoughts in this adjuvant setting?
And the patient had surgery, and what was the number of lymph nodes that they had positive?
Doesn't say, but maybe she'll add it in.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. This is a very high-risk patient. In a situation like this, I would typically track ctDNA, and if the tumor ctDNA, if there is detected ctDNA, I would try to get this patient adjuvant therapy, usually with trastuzumab, pembrolizumab. What we know from study after study after study published already, that if you're ctDNA positive, you're essentially stage 4. So I would make a case to their payer or insurance company. Hopefully it's not a Medicare patient, because Medicare doesn't negotiate. But I would submit I would submit HER2 directed therapy as if this patient was stage four, if ctDNA positive. If ctDNA negative, I think you just have to watch.
So we'll get to Zev in a second, but just to clarify, what kind of ctDNA assay are you talking about? Is this like a Signatera type bespoke assay? Or you at Memorial, you're developing a circulating assay yourself, right?
Yeah, we have MSK Access. If they're positive on MSK Access, they're definitely positive. That I have no problem calling them stage four, because it's more of a diagnostic, just in general for as opposed to MRD assay. If Signatera is positive also, if tumor-informed assay is positive, I would be very concerned about this patient. I think otherwise it would be hard to, there's no data for adjuvant HER2-directed therapy, so it's hard to justify.
And Zev, you know, when we met, that was one of the main things you brought up. And oncologists bring this up all the time. Sure, they're different diseases, but, more and more, we're seeing them start to cross tumor lines. Oncologists are used to thinking pre-op, anti-HER therapy, chemo, for sure. And then we'll see you next. Then they come here and they go, really, we're not going to do it? And they're HER2 positive. But there was a study that was negative, correct, Zev? I think it was trastuzumab.
There have been adjuvant studies that were negative with chemo radiation. That was an RTOG study published a few years ago. I mean, some of the challenge has been that, the reason it's challenging is that it's not as common in some ways as breast cancer, as we all know. It is a little more common around the world, of course, in Southeast Asia. But in Southeast Asia, the adjuvant, neoadjuvant thing is much different than it is in the United States. In a lot of countries in Southeast Asia, patients get surgery first for gastric cancer. So, it's been tough to do these studies. People have been trying to do these studies in gastric cancer for a number of years, learning from breast cancer. Like, let's do everything neoadjuvant and HER2 positive. And studies have trouble enrolling. There's quality control issues. It requires a huge effort to get these studies done in gastric, which is a lot more difficult than in breast cancer, which is why, as much as I'd love to say, gosh, let's give every neoadjuvant HER2-positive patient with gastric cancer trastuzumab, we just don't have data to prove that that's the right thing to do. So we're kind of stuck with that. Now, sometimes in practice, big bulky disease hovering between metastatic and locally advanced disease, I think it's reasonable there, and I've done it before in many circumstances.
So let's talk about first-line therapy and, of course, the classic Keynote 811 study that Yelena led. But, Yelena, a little more feedback from the chat room from Neela. She says 13 lymph nodes were removed and they're all negative and he doesn't have Medicare.
All right, well, so just Signatera and see. Node negative, that's pretty good. And do we know PD-L1 status?
Well, we'll see if she brings it in here, no. But let's just follow
up. I never
up,
make it that easy, right? I keep asking
that's
questions.
That's okay. Like I said, we got a great chat room here. Okay, let's talk about HER2 positive and the 811 study. Why don't I go to Zev, since this, Yelena talked about it in her talk. How do you define HER2 positive? Seems like a simple question, but maybe not. What's your first line therapy? Particularly, how does PD-L1 fit in, a la the 811 study? And we just talked about the future of neoadjuvant adjuvant. Let's focus on what you do today, Zev.
So HER2 positive, I think that one I feel pretty good about. It's 3+ is positive in gastric or gastroesophageal. 2+ reflects this to FISH. If it's FISH positive, they're positive. If they're FISH negative, they're negative. That, I think, more or less, there's consensus now. We're as good as consensus as we're going to get in that regard in gastroesophageal cancer for HER2 positive definitions. With respect to, metastatic disease frontline, I think the Keynote 811 study that Yelena published a few months ago is clear and convincing evidence that we should be using pembrolizumab with chemo and trastuzumab in all patients with HER2 positive disease, with the exception of the PD-L1 negative cohort, which is small, but maybe 10 or 15% of patients, that's where, and Yelena knows this data better than myself, but that's where there is some questions, obviously, as to whether the endpoints were definitive. But and the FDA did amend the approval. But certainly that study, which I think is practice-changing, both initially response and now PFS and at some point OS, you know, I think we should give all patients who – there's no reason not to give all patients with HER2-positive disease chemo, pembro, plus trastuzumab.
So, Yelena, of course, here's the 8-11 data that we were just talking about, and the follow-up, you know, the initial data and the approval, of course, was regardless of PD-1 level. Now with this follow-up data, it's just in CPS. But one thing I was curious about, because as Zev said, there are, you know, relatively few people, I think like 15%, who are CP1. You know, the famous line from Richard Pito, the lack of evidence of a benefit is not evidence of a lack of benefit. So do we, I mean, I guess the hazard rate wasn't, you know, positive, but do we know that these people don't benefit, Yelena?
No, we don't. And I think what really made people nervous, and I think, you know, Florian showed that the survival curves in the his discussion at ESMO is the flipping of the survival curves, that it looked like perhaps there's detriment because of the hazard ratios. But, you know, it's we have other data from joint phase two studies from us and, you know, Yancey, who had also a similar study, and also our internal data set that we reviewed at. I don't believe that there's a detriment, but it's that being said, the FDA and the regulatory authorities in Europe are being cautious, which is totally understandable. I think I find it really unfair to the patients, HER2-positive PD-L1 negative tumor patients, because the downfall of that is now we're designing a phase three study, for example, the next phase three study in this space. Obviously, you know, we're continuing to innovate and move forward, and we have to do something different from those for those patients and sort of put them in a different bucket. And so it just gets really messy with, but that's what we have to do. Research is not easy. It's hard. But I don't believe that you're hurting those patients if you enroll them into trials with combination strategies, but you can't give them the same stuff you would give other patients, which is pembrolizumab, trastuzumab, chemo.
So, Yelena, a little bit more from Neela about the case. The patients on the CINJ study, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, it's a phase two trial. The patient's CPS is more than 5. You will get 2 pre-op and 16 post-op pembro.
Okay, perfect. So just throw in some he's still on the study.
Him off the study and put him on add in trastuzumab.
Is this thing recorded?
No, nobody's hearing this, Yelena. All right, we'll just pass on that.
Check Signatera. Check Signatera. You have to do what's Signatera. Right for the patient. You know, so.
Okay, all right. Okay, TDXD. I feel like we talk about this every day, whether we're in lung cancer, breast cancer, GI, and you name it. It's biliary tract, bladder, we just did at the ASCO GU meeting. Okay, TDXD, just more follow-up. Obviously, you guys are way ahead of the other non-breast people. You know, the biliary people, they're still trying to figure out how to, you know, pre-medicate, et cetera. But we have a lot more mature data here, you know, some of the most mature data, I think. So here are the clinical questions that come up that I hear, Zev. What's your usual second-line therapy? Are there, you know, what about if somebody has, you know, maybe some prior lung issues, et cetera? How do you manage GI toxicities? We're seeing, you know, as these come into these other specialties, the specialists don't have the experience that the general oncologists do. So acute GI toxicities, how do you prevent it and manage it? And of course, the big question, how do you screen for ILDs, Zev?
Yeah, so I think, by the way, the general oncologists have a lot more experience with this drug than we do in gastric cancer, because there's so many breast cancer patients getting it now across the board. HER2-low, and obviously that's another, a lot of big group of patients. But in gastric cancer and gastroesophageal cancers, I think this is a reasonable thing to do in second line, and with the caveat being I am still a believer that you should be checking that HER2 when they progress, that in some capacity, whether it's a biopsy or a ctDNA, and that's an important distinction maybe from breast cancer. We do see reproducibly in a number of studies that, you know, there aren't as many patients who are first-line HER2 positive that stay HER2 positive. And I don't think it's just a heterogeneity issue at this point. I think there's a lot of interesting science and literature that has suggested we should be biopsying, or if not biopsying, ctDNA in these patients. Now, if they're positive, I do like T-DXd in this context. And I have seen the GI toxicities, and there's certainly something challenging. I think that the interstitial lung disease component is relatively new for us, and I think there's a few things that we're learning. Number one, obviously, we have to screen out patients who have any ILD. Grade 1 ILD is a challenge. What do you do with those patients? Anything above grade 1, I think we probably don't use this drug at all, in my opinion. But we certainly would – we like to get a pulmonologist to weigh in, and they're seeing these patients all the time now to help guide that decision. The other – the third point that is not brought up here is the dose, and I think the dose here should be mentioned, because in other cancers, people are using 5.4 milligram per kilogram, and in gastric cancer, technically the FDA approval is 6.4, and that's because the study was done. And I think that based on a recent data set suggesting – no detriment in efficacy and better toxicity with 5.4 in colon cancer, randomized study, 5.4 versus 6.4, was presented at ASCO, and there was no decrease in efficacy and better toxicity, of course. I think we should be considering that dose as well in gastric cancer.
I think they saw the same thing in lung. Yelena, any thoughts? You know, this issue of checking the HER2 on progression, you know, the general oncologist, they hear from the breast people. They don't do that. Once they're HER2 positive, they're HER2 positive. Also, what about the issue of HER2 low? Obviously, T-DXd in breast, we have some great data. It's being looked at. What about here?
So we are looking at HER2 low in DESTINY-Gastric03. There's a cohort. So trying to answer the question. Actually, in that study, the T-DXd is being combined with capecitabine and immunotherapy. So to Zev's point, 5.4 is the better dose for those patients. You know, I think in clinical practice, realistically, for ILD, the only way that you need to screen is really educate your patients and ask them to report any upper sort of respiratory symptoms, and also review your scans very carefully, because often, you know, these small lung, subtle lung changes are not included in the impression, and they're only briefly mentioned in the body of the report. And so I look at the scans usually myself and read the reports very carefully. And beyond that, we don't really need to do any additional testing. It's a well-tolerated drug, better tolerated in second line than third line. So the way that I approach it is I use biopsies to help me decide where to use the drug in which setting. For biopsy-proven HER2-positive tumors at the time of trastuzumab progression, it's better to prioritize T-DXd and use it in second line. But similar to the breast colleagues, I do not preclude patients from using the T-DXd in third line, even if HER2-positive status was lost in second line setting. I use then Taxol, ramucirumab in second line, and then reserve T-DXd in third line. And I've had, you know, good responses with that as well, because beyond just loss of HER2 in just one sample, there could be other lesions that are still HER2 positive.
One kind of difference I see, and the breast people say, if the patient has ILD and has any symptoms, they're not going to get rechallenged, even if they respond to steroids and they're doing well. I don't necessarily always hear that kind of permeating out beyond breast cancer, but is that your approach? If they have symptoms, that's it.
That's
so you
it.
Got, you
Unless
try to pick it up on on imaging.
No, I don't. I mean, if it's really grade one and there's, you know, maybe, you know, because I have patients who have, you know, we're in the age of COVID still, or they have maybe lung disease, so you're not convinced it's ILD. And then there's a bit of a sort of consensus that we reach with pulmonary radiology and so forth. I get all three, you know, specialists on the phone, and we really try to make an educated assessment. And if I think it's, everybody thinks it's ILD, I don't like to rechallenge. It's too scary. I mean, let's face it, it's stage four second line therapy. If you really have ILD, if you don't do well, you may never get to third line.
So zanidatamab, a HER2 bispecific, you guys actually are ahead of the breast people. Actually, Zev, when we talked about this, you said it actually is being looked at in breast. We found a paper at San Antonio, so they are kind of picking up on us, but you all sort of have taken the lead. What exactly, maybe you can just kind of talk about what zanidatamab actually is. Of course, we talk a lot about bispecific CD3 bispecific, but this is different. What kind of toxicities do you see? Where do you see it fitting into practice? And what about studies looking at earlier, like the Horizon GEA study that I will show you in a second? So, Zev, get us started on Zani.
Okay. Interesting drug. It's a bispecific, but not blocking a separate antigen. It blocks two separate extracellular domains within HER2. Conceptually, that would mean better HER2 blockade without the addition of, let's say, blocking a second antigen. So, you know, what's interesting about this drug is that, you know, it's been around for a while, and there have been a bunch of phase 1 and phase 2 studies. It has some single agent activity in gastroesophageal cancer. That's been demonstrated. That's probably distinguishing it from trastuzumab. Never had any single agent activity in gastroesophageal cancer, and certainly has a nice response rate in frontline patients in this phase 1/2 study with a tolerable toxicity profile, maybe a little more GI toxicity than obviously trastuzumab alone, but certainly provocative results in this phase 2 study. So they launched a randomized phase 3 trial, obviously before the KEYNOTE-811 study results were available. So they took the same patient population, newly diagnosed, but they actually did a 3-arm study with the control arm here being trastuzumab plus chemo, arguably not the control arm anymore for this disease because of the KEYNOTE-811 study. And they had two separate experimental arms. One is just seeing, oh, are we better than trastuzumab with zanidatamab alone in arm B here? And arm C obviously combines the zanidatamab plus chemo plus tislelizumab. So again, arm C is where the expectation would be a positive study if it's positive. And how will people incorporate that remains to be seen. Is that sufficiently different from the KEYNOTE-811 results? Obviously, we have to wait and see. Study tried to get at contribution of components, obviously, and that's why SEI was designed in that way. But the results, it's a large study because it's 3 arms. The results, to my knowledge, won't be around for at least a year. So we'll have to wait for that result to see if it's going to be part of our options.
So, Yelena, any comments about Zani? Have you actually used it in a patient on trial?
I've used it. I think it's a great drug. I think trastuzumab is a great drug. Also, it's well-tolerated. We actually have not ever done a single-agent study. In fact, I think back in the day when I was starting in GI, I tracked down one of the investigators who was given IST for a small phase in Germany for a single agent trast study. And I think he enrolled about 14, 15 patients and he never published the study, but he told me the response that he saw was about 20% with single agent. But I think Zani's more modern agent, very effective. I've used it. We, did a phase 2 at MSK that actually contribute to the phase 3. Unfortunately in the United States, the phase 3 could not really enroll because how can you randomize patients to a non-IO containing arm? I think the more the merrier. If we get the drug in our clinic, we would definitely find places to use it. My experience with the medicine is that it does cause more diarrhea, surprisingly. Similar to what, trast pertuzumab combination. And just way of caution, historically in gastric, targeting HER2 just in a better, fancier way with pertuzumab, trastuzumab, or trastuzumab, lapatinib didn't really go that far. And we needed to go outside of HER2 axis, again, because gastric is just complicated. There's more chromosomal instability, RTK activation downstream, and so forth. So we'll see. Hopefully it's positive.
Yeah, and maybe adding IO will make a big difference. And, maybe it'll be you know, I'm always the optimist, you know, such a great response in that triplet arm that, you know, people are going to want to use it or do another study or et cetera. All right, let's talk about zolbetuximab. Let's talk about
zolbetuximab. And it's early enough that maybe they'll go to early, you know, early stage disease, right? To your earlier
point. Right. So zolbetuximab, Claudin 18.2, this is a gigantic, huge issue, not just because it's a positive trial, much more importantly is being ready to use this drug, which is not going to be as straightforward, I think, as a lot of other new agents that have come into oncology, as Zev and I discussed at length in his presentation. Zev, maybe you can just kind of summarize where we are. We obviously have, you know, two phase three trials that are positive, very similar results, both with positive PFS and survival, but also a lot of studies looking at the issue, including a presentation at just the GI meeting a couple weeks ago, the issue of nausea and vomiting, which is really different in this situation. So can you kind of provide an overview of these issues, Zev? And here are some of the questions we have about this.
Yeah, so this is the new biomarker on the block here, and I think the studies were well conducted and both met their endpoint for progression-free survival and their secondary endpoints for overall survival. That when you add Claudin 18.2 antibody zolbetuximab to chemo, you improve these outcomes. Now, how do you measure it is actually very challenging. For now, there's different assays being utilized in the study. Obviously, they use the what will ultimately be, when the drug is approved, hopefully in the next 6 months, a companion diagnostic antibody. But we're already seeing multiple antibodies being tested, which there hasn't been definitive comparisons here. The expectation is that this won't be sufficiently different. But in the study, they used a much higher cutoff than we think is truly positive, and that's because the study was done in a tighter group of patients. In the real world, the big questions that are evolving are, well, does the expression need to be that high? Is 70% expression, can you target a lower cutoff rate and develop these second generation drugs? And that's what people are doing now. They're going, whether it's the, you know, second generation antibodies or antibody drug conjugates, the cutoff may not be need to be that high. Just keep that in mind for the future. For now, for zolbetuximab, that is probably the cutoff that will be listed in the companion diagnostic once the drug is approved. And so for the context of how we're going to deal with this unique toxicity, which is nausea and vomiting. And when I say unique, it's not like the nausea and vomiting you get from cisplatin or carboplatin or other chemos. Those are centrally induced nausea vomiting. Here it's a different kind of nausea vomiting. It's an on-target toxicity almost that is a class effect of all Claudin 18.2 agents. So that includes severe nausea and vomiting, in my opinion, sometimes in the chair during the infusion, sometimes the day or two after. Now, the tricks of the trade that I think have been suggested, and I've got a lot of experience with these drugs, and some of these, my experience has worked, is that prolonging the infusion time, giving sometimes H1, H2 blockers, and possibly even dexamethasone on the day of infusion, sometimes separating the infusion from the chemotherapy, if need be, by a day. These are not going to be simple drugs. I completely agree with you, Neil, for a lot of community oncologists, 12 very few patients, technically speaking, who meet the criteria for this drug. And so there's going to be a steep learning curve here, as there often is, and talking to people who have used these drugs is kind of what I've thought might be helpful.
And, informing nurses, I think, is going to be critical, because your point about slowing the infusion down, that seems to be the most effective. Anything you want to add to that? I'll just sort of go through a few of the slides that Zev showed in his talk, you know, here looking at mechanism of action. But anything you want to say, first of all, about the efficacy data, Yelena? Any concerns that you have? Do you feel that this is a significant move forward? And again, Zev talked a lot about some of these other strategies, antibody-drug conjugates, bispecifics. And, you know, we're starting to see actually some data from these, and also the issue of overlap. We have some patients, I think maybe 10 or 20% are going to be both PD-1 positive and Claudin 18.2. What are we going to do there, Yelena? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is an important step forward. practice-changing studies critical to test for biomarker and then prioritize based on level of expression. And realistically, this is just an opening into the new realm. And it's interesting, some of the ADCs that we're seeing, you know, the toxicity actually is not quite as severe as zolbetuximab for nausea with some of the antibody drug conjugates. We'll have to just see how the data matures. You know, I think prioritization of MSI status, then HER2 as a biomarker, then PD-L1 high CPS 5 or greater for immune checkpoint blockade, but, you know, usually with HER2-directed therapy for HER2-positive disease, and then zolbetuximab right now for claudin-positive patients. It's a, there's a substantial percent of patients that do not have HER2, MSI, or high PD-L1 that will benefit from these agents. Of course, because there's no improvement in overall response rate in first-line setting, the other strategies, checkpoint blockade-containing strategies, may be more appealing for patients that are appropriate for immunotherapy biomarkers.
Seb, anything else you want to say about the, any pearls? You know, very few people have actually had the experience in terms of the nausea and vomiting. Anything else you want to add to that? And also, the, I mean, you mentioned to me that these the antibody drug conjugates and CAR T and all that, they do also cause nausea and vomiting.
Yeah, I mean, to Joanna's point, it may not be as dramatic as some of the zolbetuximab data. We're also seeing, you know, the ADC data that's been public. Most of it has come from Southeast Asia, as you saw a few months ago in that presentation. So, I mean, we're going to see maybe different things here. I think we have to be prepared. I mean, I think one trick that we've noticed is certainly that it gets better on subsequent infusions. But I do totally agree with warning the nurses, being very careful about warning patients about this, because I don't know if this isn't something they might not have encountered. So, and also the other pearl that we seems to be convincing based on the existing literature is that the patients who have had gastrectomy, who have had either gastrectomy or esophagectomy, don't have this symptom to the same extent. So they may have some of it, but the nausea and vomiting is not as extreme. So, you know, when you have to think about which patient, for example. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out. I think a lot of education is going to be critical here.
Yeah, really interesting about the surgery. So, Yelena and Zeb, thank you so much. Really, it was great to speak with you again. Audience, thank you for attending. Check out their presentations. Come on back next Tuesday. I just heard about a really interesting study in Hodgkin lymphoma that I want to get your opinion on, early stage disease that includes not only chemo, but nivolumab and brentuximab. So kind of cool. All right. Have a great night, and thank you so much. Thanks, Yelena.
Bye.
Thanks, Zev.
Thanks, Neil. Bye-bye. Have a good night.